Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Cold Cases Solved, Volume 3, 18 Fascinating True Crime Cases, by Robert Keller, narrated by Gary Tiedemann. To Catch a Killer. Sitting in the auditorium at a 1998 homicide conference in Florida, Captain James Tucker could hardly believe what he was hearing. Tucker was attending the seminar as a representative of the Portsmouth Police Department in New Hampshire. The officer currently on stage was from NCIS, Naval Criminal Investigative Service. His presentation had to do with the killing of a young Navy wife, Dina Kickler, who'd been raped and strangled at her home in Mayport, Florida, on December 3, 1990. What really caught Tucker's attention was the similarity to an unsolved case he had on his books, the 1987 murder of 23-year-old Michelle LaFond. Then, the NCIS agent put a picture of his victim up on screen, and Tucker's level of interest went up another notch. Dina Kickler and Michelle LaFond looked very much alike. They could have been sisters. Michelle LaFond had met her terrible death at her home in Dublin, New Hampshire, on March 4, 1987. It was her husband, Gary, who had the misfortune of finding her. He'd come home from work to find the house in disarray and his wife's naked body in an upstairs bathroom. Her hair was wet, suggesting that her killer had placed her in a tub of water at some point. He'd also bound her wrists and ankles and subjected her to a savage rape before strangling her to death. Michelle LaFond had been 4 months pregnant at the time of her death. The Portsmouth police worked the case hard, focusing on Michelle and Gary LaFond's inner circle. The lack of forced entry suggested that Michelle might have known her killer and let him into the house. They had semen from the victim's body, but the sample wasn't sufficient for a DNA match using 1987 technology. Despite the best efforts of investigators, the case had slipped away from them and gone cold. Now, Captain Tucker was listening to the details of another tragedy involving a young woman on the other side of the country. Like Michelle LaFond, Dina Kickler was an attractive young woman, recently married, living a happy life. Michelle had been 23. Dina was 21 years old and the mother of a 2-year-old son. Her husband, Pat, was a naval officer serving aboard the USS Forrestal. On the morning of Monday, December 3, 1990, the day that Dina was killed, Pat was away on deployment. Dina's son was visiting his grandparents. Dina was home alone. Dina Kickler was employed at an optic store in Jacksonville at this time. Her outgoing personality made her popular with colleagues and customers alike. She was also an unfailingly reliable person, so when she failed to show up at work that morning, there was immediate concern. Friend and co-worker Amy Stark tried calling her, but got no reply. Amy then decided to drive over to Mayport Landing, a complex for military families, where Dina lived. The first sign of something untoward was when Amy spotted her friend's car in the driveway. If Dina was home, why wasn't she answering her phone? Amy parked her car and got out. She started towards the house, then stopped. A chill ran down her spine. Something was wrong here. Very wrong. In any case, she wasn't going any further. Reaching into her purse, she retrieved her phone and called the police. Amy Stark's decision not to enter the house turned out to be a wise one. It spared her a glimpse into the horror that lay within. The patrolman who picked up the call noticed something wrong the minute he stepped through the door. There was blood pooled in the foyer and clear signs of a struggle. The officer followed a trail of blood upstairs. On the floor of the master bedroom was a pile of blankets from which a human foot protruded. The officer backed out of the room, returned to his cruiser, and called it in. Dina Kickler had been savagely raped, brutally killed. Her life had been snuffed out with a length of rope, twisted into a tourniquet around her slender neck. There were blood spatters throughout the house, as well as tufts of dark hair, which appear to have been snipped from the victim, most likely by her killer. Plenty of forensic evidence was gathered, including a cigarette butt and three hairs, determined to be from the inner thigh, the leg, and the pubic area. These were found on the blanket covering Dina's body, but they weren't hers. Most likely, they were from her killer. The other important piece of information to emerge from that initial sweep was the way in which the killer had gained entry into the home. None of the doors or windows had been forced. It appeared that Dina Kichler had let him in, meaning that they were probably acquainted. That narrowed the suspect pool considerably. Dina Kichler, as we have already mentioned, was a physically attractive woman. But what really drew people to her was her personality. Friendly and vivacious, she was seldom without a smile or a kind word. This had gained her many admirers. Several of her colleagues at the optic store appeared to have a crush on her, and three of these men were flagged as suspects. They were eliminated from the inquiry when the hair samples they provided did not match those found at the crime scene. The investigators then expanded their net to include other males in the Kichler's inner circle. That was when the name John Brewer first came up. Brewer was a native of New Hampshire who worked on the naval base as a painter and lived in the same complex as Pat and Dina Kichler. His name was first brought to the attention of investigators when they found it in an address book at the couple's home. Further inquiries revealed that he had a record, mostly for minor infractions, but with a couple of burglary convictions thrown in. Brought in for questioning, Brewer admitted that he was on friendly terms with Pat and Dina Kichler. He'd visited them at their apartment several times, he said. In fact, he'd promised Pat that he'd look out for Dina while Pat was away at sea. Brewer then asked the detectives if he could light up a cigarette while they talked. The brand he smoked was the same as the butt found at the crime scene. And something else caught the attention of investigators. Brewer's hands were swollen, and he had several cuts across his knuckles. John Brewer had now been elevated to the top of the suspect list. One simple test would prove his guilt or clear him as a person of interest. He was asked to provide hair samples for a comparison and agreed right away. The investigators were sure that they had their man. They were as surprised as anyone when the test results came back as inconclusive. The reason for this mismatch would only become clear once the samples were sent to the FBI crime lab for a more comprehensive test. There, it would be revealed that Brewer had duped the Florida investigators. He'd provided hair samples from other parts of his body. Officers were then dispatched to bring Brewer back in, but their suspect was long gone. It would take the police a year before they eventually tracked him down. Then, the correct samples were obtained, and a match was made. On December 12, 1991, John Brewer was taken into custody and charged with the first-degree murder of Dina Kichler. Brewer was held without bond while prosecutors built their case against him. However, this would not prove to be the slam dunk that many believed. Brewer was a wily character who was no doubt aware that his biological material might have been found at the crime scene. During his initial interview with detectives, he'd been at pains to stress that he had been inside the Kichler residence prior to the murder. This hadn't just been randomly thrown into the conversation. Brewer was laying the groundwork for reasonable doubt. Any half-competent defense attorney would be able to argue that his DNA might have been left at the scene under entirely innocent circumstances. And that was also how Circuit Judge Lawrence Haddock saw it. In November 1993, he set Brewer free, ruling that the state of Florida did not have sufficient cause to hold him. At this stage, the case was dead in the water. If John Brewer was indeed the killer of Dina Kichler, then he appeared to have gotten away with it. For the next 7 years, he probably believed that he had. But then came that conference and the presentation by the NCIS agent. Then came the realization by Captain James Tucker that the murder of Dena Kichler had much in common with his own cold case. After the presentation, the officers got together and exchanged notes. They soon realized that they both had biological evidence, the hairs that had been matched to John Brewer, and the sperm sample that had yet to find a match. What were the chances that these two samples, deposited 1,200 miles apart, at opposite ends of the country, were a match to each other? The chances, as it turned out, were very good. DNA tests would prove that they had the same donor, John Brewer. Brewer was arrested in April 1998 and charged with 2 counts of first-degree murder. He was then presented with a stark choice. Prosecutors in both states were determined to seek the death penalty. His only chance of avoiding the needle was to come clean. With little option but to comply, Brewer accepted the offer that was on the table, entering guilty pleas at trial and accepting 2 life terms with no possibility of parole. Describing the murders, Brewer said that he had deliberately befriended his victims and their husbands in order to gain their confidence. Gary LaFond had been a work colleague of his. Pat and Dena Kichler had been his neighbors. He'd called on the women when he knew their husbands were away. Gary at work, Pat on deployment at sea. Both Michelle and Dena had let him in when he'd arrived unannounced at their homes. He'd attacked the minute he was through the door. The women were beaten into submission, raped, and then strangled to death. Brewer then departed the scene, unaware that he'd left behind the biological evidence that would ultimately bring about his downfall. Every contact leaves a trace is the credo of forensic investigation. In this case, it had come up trumps. But one question remains to be answered. Were Michelle LaFond and Dena Kichler the only victims of this cold-hearted killer? Given what we know of this personality type, it seems unlikely. There is every chance that more murders will be linked to John Brewer in the future. We might not have heard the last of him. Deadly Mr. Bean. His name was Clarence Oliver Bean Jr., Ollie to his friends. He wasn't much to look at, but he was quite the Casanova. Ollie had a wife, he had a mistress, and he had children by both. The women lived a short distance from each other in Luther, Michigan, and they were aware of each other. In fact, they'd even become friends over time. Judy Bean had married Ollie in 1968 and would remain with him for 32 years, bearing 3 sons and a daughter during that time. But this was not a happy union. Ollie was an abusive man who frequently beat his wife and children. He was also a serial philanderer who liked to flaunt his affairs to his wife. One of those was with a divorced mother of one named Diane Chorba. It is uncertain when this relationship started, but Judy first became aware of it in 1977, by which time Diane already had a 1-year-old son, Joshua, by Ollie. Under such circumstances, you might have expected Judy and Diane to become sworn enemies, but the opposite was true. The women had plenty of war stories to exchange regarding their relationships with Ollie. They became fast friends, even babysitting each other's kids. And then, in 1979, came the event that would topple Ollie Bean's comfortable arrangement. Diane was pregnant again, and Judy was ready to step aside so that Ollie could do the right thing. She urged him to divorce her and marry Diane, to be there for his 2 young children. This wasn't entirely altruistic on Diane's part. Most likely, she saw it as an opportunity to escape the abusive marriage. Unfortunately, Ollie wasn't buying it. He liked things just the way they were, with 2 women at his beck and call. "You're going nowhere," he told his wife. "The only way you're leaving me is over my dead body." On July 20th, 1979, police in Luther, Michigan received a call from Diane Chorba's concerned relatives. No one in the family had heard from Diane or from her children in over 2 months. Officers were dispatched to check it out and started with the name that Diane's family had given them, Ollie Bean. At the Bean residence, at least part of the mystery would be resolved. Diane's 13-year-old daughter, Victoria, and her 1-year-old son, Joshua, were living with Ollie and his family. As for Diane, well, Ollie had an explanation for her whereabouts. Diane was dead. She'd been killed in a plane crash. The story that Ollie had to tell went something like this. According to him, Diane had asked him to drive her to Big Rapids, Michigan, where she was meeting up with a friend. He'd done this, he said, dropping her at Robin Hood Airport, just outside the city limits, on May 24th. From there, Diane and her friend were planning to take a flight to Chicago and fly from there to California. They were booked on American Airlines Flight 191 the next day. The detectives already knew the rest. Flight 191 had crashed on takeoff from O'Hare on May 25th, 1979, killing 258 passengers and 13 crew. It was one of the worst air disasters in U.S. history. This story provided a convenient explanation for Diane Chorba's sudden disappearance. But was it true? Investigators contacted the aviation authorities to find out. What they had learned was more or less what they'd expected. All of the air crash victims had been identified, and Diane Chorba was not one of them. Detectives then returned to question Ollie, who remained adamant that Diane had been aboard the flight. Then, when it became clear that his story was inaccurate, he changed tack. Now he suggested that Diane might have boarded a different plane. "She's more than likely laying low in California," he said, hinting that she probably wanted to avoid her parental responsibilities. The cops did not believe a word of it. They asked Ollie to take a polygraph. He agreed. The results were inconclusive. In 1980, less than a year after Diane Chorba disappeared, Ollie Bean uprooted his family and moved them to Oregon, taking Joshua and Victoria with them. Here he would remain for the next 2 decades while he continued to work as a long-haul trucker and continued to make life miserable for his wife and kids. The thing is, when you live by violence, it often comes back to haunt you. In 1999, Ollie was involved in a domestic altercation, during which shots were fired. A bullet hit him in the back, inflicting an injury that would leave him partially paralyzed. One of his own children had wielded the gun. Ollie was still in the hospital recovering from his injuries when Judy contacted the authorities back in Michigan. She had information to share. She knew what had happened to Diane Chorba. According to Judy, Ollie had been truthful about one thing. Diane was dead, only it wasn't a plane crash that had ended her life. It was Ollie's murderous hand. He'd killed Diane on May 24th, 1979, the same day he claimed to have driven her to Big Rapids. Ollie had left home early that day, driving away at 5 a.m., telling Judy that he was going to Diane's house. He'd returned 3.5 hours later, with Diane and Joshua in tow. He'd then handed Joshua to Judy, telling her to watch the toddler for a while. Then he and Diane departed. When Ollie returned some hours later, he was alone. He told Judy that he had killed Diane and that he needed his chainsaw to get rid of the body. When he was ready to leave again, he insisted that Judy accompany him and bring the baby with her. Judy was terrified, afraid that she and Joshua were also about to be killed. But she'd been with Ollie long enough to know that refusing him wasn't an option. The location Ollie brought his wife to was in a heavily wooded area off a remote, dead-end road in Bristol, Michigan, around 9 miles from their residence. Here, he pointed out Diane's lifeless body, lying face down in a depression made by an uprooted tree. The back of Diane's head was bloodied. Judy assumed that she had been shot. Ollie stooped over the body and removed Diane's jewelry. Then He fired up the chainsaw. For one dreadful moment, Judy thought that he was about to dismember the corpse right there in front of her. Instead, Ollie started hacking away at the tree trunk. As it separated from the base, the root and stump fell back into place, covering Diane's body. Ollie then scooped some dirt in around the roots, and the job was complete. Later, as they were driving home, he told Judy that he'd killed Diane because she had been pressuring him to leave Judy and marry her. She'd threatened to take off with the children if he did not comply. The way Ollie saw it, he'd been left with no choice. Judy Bean would later lead officers to the site where Diane was buried. The tree stump was there, exactly as she'd described, but the space beneath it was empty. Cadaver dogs were then brought in and indicated that a dead body had once been there. It seems that Ollie had returned to the site to move it prior to his move to Oregon. Ollie Bean was charged with the first-degree murder of Diane Chorba in August of 2001. 22 years after Diane's death, he was finally hauled before a judge and jury to take responsibility for his actions. But this was not going to be an easy case to make. It rested heavily on the testimony of Judy Bean. All that Ollie's defense had to argue was that Judy was a vindictive woman and that there was no evidence that Diane Chorba was dead. That might be enough to constitute reasonable doubt. If the jury saw it that way, Ollie Bean would walk. In the end, neither side got what it wanted. Clarence Oliver Bean was acquitted on first-degree charges, but convicted of second-degree murder. He was sentenced to 30 to 60 years in prison, more or less a life sentence given his age and poor state of health. Bean later appealed his conviction, citing a Michigan spousal privilege law that would have required him to give his consent for Judy to testify against him. Unfortunately for Ollie, that particular law had been repealed 1 year before his trial and had been applied retroactively. His appeal was denied. Diane Chorba has never been found, although that is not for the lack of trying. Every year, a new search is launched, and every year, Judy Bean flies out to Michigan to assist in the effort. Meanwhile, the one person who knows the location of the body remains mute. Ollie Bean has nothing to say on the matter. The Coward's Way. Thornton, Colorado is a small working-class community situated some 12 miles north of downtown Denver. Back in the 1980s, it was home to the Grimes family, single mom Gwen and her daughters, Deanna, 16, and Nanine, 15. This was a close-knit unit. The girls, with just a year between them, hung out together, had the same friends, liked the same music and fashion. The Grimes backyard was often a gathering place for the local teens. Gwen also loved spending time with her daughters, and they with her. This was a happy home, filled with love and laughter. On the night of September 4th, 1980, that happiness would be brought to a horrific end. Nanine was home alone that night. Deanna was at her after-school job, and Gwen was visiting her boyfriend. But being alone wasn't that much of a big deal for Nanine. She was a responsible kid and planned to spend the evening doing her homework and listening to music. When Deanna got home at around 10 p.m., she fully expected to find her sister lounging on the couch, the radio blaring out some rock station. Only Nanine wasn't on the couch. The radio was on, but Nanine was nowhere to be seen. And she'd left the place in a mess, with her school books scattered about and a soda can dripping its sticky contents onto the carpet. "I'm going to kill her," Deanna muttered under her breath. "Nini," she called out as she headed down the hall. Then, as Deanna passed her own room, she caught a whiff of something unpleasant. Stopping in the doorway, she peered into the darkness. Then she flicked on the light, blinking against the sudden glare. There was water on the floor, A lot of it, tinged an odd pinkish color. Deanna scanned her eye towards her waterbed and noticed that it had collapsed. There was something lying within the folds of the bed, something that Deanna's brain could barely register. Was that the outline of a body? Turning, Deanna sprinted from the house, ran to her neighbors, pounded on the door. "I think there's somebody dead in my room," she blurted out. Adams County deputies were soon racing towards the scene. Before they arrived, Deanna called her mother and told her that she should come home immediately. By the time Gwen got there, crime scene tape had been strung, and the street was clogged with police cruisers. Gwen tried to enter the property, but was prevented from doing so by a deputy. Informed that her 15-year-old daughter was dead, Gwen initially refused to believe it. "That's a lie," she yelled, when Deanna told her the terrible news. Then, as the truth kicked in, Gwen drew her daughter into an embrace, and they stood there, sobbing pitifully. Inside the house, homicide investigators were dealing with the most gruesome crime scene that most of them had ever been exposed to. It appeared that Nanine Grimes had initially been attacked in the lounge, then forced at knife point to her sister's bedroom. Blood spatters on the wall marked the path she'd walked. Inside the room, the killer had used a knife to cut open the front of Nanine's t-shirt. It seems obvious that sexual assault was his intention, but the girl had fought him. Defensive wounds on her hands and arms spoke to the bravery of her fight. In the end, though, she had been overcome. The killer, probably angered by her resistance, had launched a frenzied onslaught. Nanine had been butchered, suffering 86 knife wounds in the attack, many of them fatal. This was a crime scene with plenty of forensic evidence. In the bathroom, where the killer had gone to wash up, the police found a partial fingerprint in blood on a faucet. Then there was a blood trail heading back down the passage, out of the front door, and along the side of the house. There were smears of blood on the 6-foot boundary fence, which the killer had scaled to flee the property. And the trail of blood continued for some distance on the other side of the fence. In frenzied attacks of this nature, it is quite common for the assailant to accidentally cut himself, and it appeared that that had happened here. Samples of blood were collected at each of the sites. The police expected to have a suspect in custody soon. When they did, the blood would be important for a comparison. Regrettably, that confidence of a quick arrest would prove unfounded. Two early suspects were identified, but quickly dismissed, cleared by alibis, by blood type, by a lack of any recent wounds. Likewise, a canvas of local emergency rooms turned up no one who had shown up to seek medical attention for a serious cut. Next, investigators turned to Deanna and Nanine's circle of friends. Again, no one matched the suspect they were looking for. The cops even staked out Nanine's funeral, hoping that the killer might show up and do or say something incriminating. If he was in attendance, he did nothing to incriminate himself. And then, an altogether more terrifying prospect presented itself. Was there a serial killer stalking the streets of Thornton? The basis for this theory lay in another murder, committed 8 months before Nanine Grimes was killed. The victim was 13-year-old Kathy Boyer, knifed to death in Belroth Park, barely a mile from the Grimes residence. Was it possible that the same man had killed both teenagers? The local newspaper certainly thought so, and the police weren't ruling it out. For now, both murders remained unsolved. Cold case is typically the term used for a homicide investigation where all leads have been chased down, all suspects processed. Some of those suspects will have been cleared. Others remain as persons of interest, but with insufficient evidence to make a case against them. For now, the case is at a standstill. No one is actively working it. In that respect, the Nanine Grimes case was never truly cold. Adams County investigators were determined to solve it, confident that they'd eventually get their man.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?